I'm Ed Randall, and you're listening to Baseball and Barbecue.
Music's podcast, and you're listening to Jeff and Len on Baseball and Barbecue, one of my favorite podcasts, and I know it's one of yours too. The only problem is, after I get done listening to it, I'm hungry. All right, guys, take it away.
Welcome to episode number 102 of Baseball and BBQ. I am joined by the Shohei Ohtani of podcasting, my partner, my friend, Jeff Cohen.
Shohei Ohtani? Where do you come up with that?
Because you can do it all.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. If anybody knew, I mean, you're busy booking guests. You're busy editing. I mean, this is...
You're busy writing.
That is very true. And I book guests too. But the point is, this is your full-time job without being your full-time job.
Exactly.
It is episode 102, Jeff. And we were talking about it before we went on the air, about all the things we have. And we always forget things. And always, after we finish recording, I'm always sorry that we forgot them. So
yes,
the first thing, let's just say the first thing, is we're going to have on this episode part two of our talk with Joey Machado.
Okay.
Of Blues Hog Barbecue and Gateway Drum Smokers.
Yeah. Joey.
And yes. In the second part of the podcast, we have our interview with Tim Neverett, who has written a book that's coming out, right?
Yep. It's out now.
It's out. Okay. Right. Well, it's out now.
It's out now.
People will hear this. It is out. COVID Curveball, an inside view of the 2020 Los Angeles Dodgers World Championship season. And we had him on, so we'll talk more about
people
that.
People should know Tim Neverett is one of the play-by-play announcers for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
That's right. And that, and actually in between our interview, our second half of our interview with Joey Machado and Tim Neverett, I've got a special story to tell.
Ooh.
Yes. So stay tuned for that. But Jeff.
Yeah.
Let's start with this. We have a contest.
Contest.
I mean, I guess we just shot our production budget. Oh, boy. One of our past guests, Bree Blackford, her company is Elda's Kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And they were kind enough to approach us and they said, Hey. Did they say, hey? We would like to reward your listeners with our sauces. Right. I keep calling them barbecue sauces. Some are barbecue sauces.
Some are grilling sauces. Anyway. You can use them anyway, yeah.
Right. Three of our listeners, if you can tell us, either through the interview that we had with Bree Blackford, which was one of our episodes. She also has a website, Elda's Kitchen. But if you can tell us, who is Elda? Bree Blackford is not Elda. That's a big hint.
And it was episode number 97.
97. So you could listen to the episode. You could go to her website, Elda's Kitchen, and look at it, and
who's Elda?
That's, well, Jeff, unfortunately, you're not eligible to win this contest. Yes. Employees of this show
and their families are not
and eligible. Family members are not eligible.
So, and you can tell us a couple of ways. You can email us, baseballnbbq@gmail.com. Give us a call, 516-855-8214. And we also have some social media pages. On Facebook is baseballnbbq. Our Twitter, we're at baseballnbbq. Check us out on Instagram, baseballandbarbecue, where barbecue's all spelled out. We have a website, www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. And please, you know what to do, Len. Rate and review us.
Yes. But in this case, rate, review, but enter the contest.
Because enter the contest, yes.
You have the chance to win free sauce. And all you have to do is tell us who is Elda.
Gotcha.
And there are three winners. If we get more than three, we'll put the names in a hat and we'll pick them out the old-fashioned way.
Right.
And the sauce will be sent
directly to you.
Right from them to you. Good luck.
Right.
All right. So, Jeff,
yes.
I think we should get right into it. We should get into the second half of Joey Machado. When we last left Joey, I just happened to listen to it, and it was right as I was referring to, and where else on this podcast can you get this kind of reference, referring to Blues Hog Sauce and Seinfeld episode when Elaine was trying to determine if someone was sponge worthy. Enough said.
Please, yes. Thank you very much.
And we'll see you after Joey Machado, part two. I'm just going to tell you, Joey, I did find the sauce and I used the sauce, but awesome. I was so grateful that I found it that it was kind of like, I don't know if you're familiar with Seinfeld.
Yep.
With Elaine, and she had a certain method of birth control that she liked. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to know if her partner was sponge worthy because she didn't want to use it all up.
Exactly. Well,
I kind of felt like, I don't know if the people I'm cooking for are Blues Hog worthy.
Oh,
are
you?
You know? So I had to be very conservative with this sauce because
exactly.
At the time I didn't know if I was getting another bottle. So,
yeah.
But I just want to tell you, awesome product, Blues Hog.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about the smokers. Okay.
Yep.
So Gateway Drum Smokers.
Yes.
What is the association with Blues Hog?
So
is there an association with the two?
Yes. So there's kind of a background in this whole conversation of what Gateway means to Blues Hog and Blues Hog means to Gateway. Is Tim Shearer actually came up with this design for this drum smoker.
And he did. Okay.
You have to understand, Tim Shearer he grew up in Washington County, Missouri. And Washington County, Missouri is a farming community. So he grew up farming, and really and truly he was in tractor pulls. So he did like tractor. He was like an active tractor pull guy and that type of deal. He'd spend his time on the family farm. They had a huge pig farm down there, still do actually. He was very involved in a part of barbecue, but he wasn't actually cooking it. After he got out of college and everything else, he actually got into barbecue. As he was getting into barbecue, he figured out the best way to cook was in the drum smoker. So he's actually got his patented. The Gateway drum smoker is, you know, is his baby. There's been all kinds of versions of that cooker, but they've all been very, very similar to what is today. And Tim actually only cooks on drums. That's it. So every time that he cooks any event, every world championship he's ever won has come off of drum. Actually, as we cooked for Memphis in May, and for a lot of people who don't know, Memphis in May being the world championship contest that it is, you cook either pork ribs, pork shoulder, or whole hog. One of those three categories competing against each other is what wins Memphis in May. And the other thing that you have to do at Memphis in May is it's not just turning meat into box and blind judging type of thing. You actually have to do an on-site presentation to judges at that event. And not once, not twice, but three times. you have to go through a lot of product for that deal. So you got to cook three hogs. You got to cook, some people cook like 30, 40 racks of ribs. Some people cook 20 pork butts. And the thing is for the competition wise, they all got to be the same. So you got to cook the same quality on the number one all the way until, you know, the very last one. And so when Tim decided that he was going to go cook Memphis, because that's one trophy he did not have, is Memphis in May. It doesn't have a big Memphis in May. They've got some of the coolest trophies. So that was the goal this year, was to go down there and win Memphis in May. Not to compete, to win. We went down there, put it all together. Tim shows up. He's coming from one part of the country. I'm coming from another. We already knew that we were going to compete in shoulders. Shoulders probably one of the best categories. If you cook a hog, that's like your best shot at winning the whole contest. Shoulder is your next runner up. Ribs is like the last one, because ribs have not won that contest in like 10 years plus, something like that. Majority of the people who go there, you have a lot more people who cook ribs, a little bit less people cook shoulder, and a lot less people cook hog. If anyone ever wants to go to Memphis in May and wants to have a shot, got to cook a hog to have a real, real shot at that for your first time there. So this was Tim's second time, I think, cooking Memphis in May. So we show up there and we start pulling drums out of the trailer. And I brought drums up from Texas. We wound up with like 12 drums. And we wound up cooking that many pork butts. So, and not butts, it's shoulders. So it's actually the pork butt plus a little bit of the leg. So we can only put one of those per pit. So we actually did that on those drums. And I asked him, I said, on your practice cook, how long did it take? And he goes, I don't know. We haven't practice cooked them yet. I'm like, okay. And that's the kind of guy Tim is. Tim has an idea and he goes, this is what we're going to do. And that's what it's going to taste like. Okay. You sure? Oh, yep. It's going to happen. And that's what he is. And that's Tim is like this super, super positive guy. Everything he touches turns to gold type of person. And that's why I really enjoy working with Tim, because he's one of those guys not afraid to take on like all these extra tasks and stuff that most people go, we can't do that. And so anyway, so he did it and he winds up winning shoulder, and which is like ridiculous. And we came in this close to winning the whole Memphis in May. And again, like I said, our good friend James Cruz, he actually won rib. We win shoulder. Myron wins rib. I mean, a whole hog. Comes down to the very final. And it wound up Myron first place. We got our friend James Cruz comes in second, and we came in third overall for, you know, the way that it would land. The good thing was James Cruz used pretty much all Blues Hog products. So we kind of won. And then Myron, of course, he's just a good friend, you know. So the one thing about barbecue is it's very, very seldom that you're going to not be happy for the person who wins, especially in my case, because I kind of know everybody. So I'm always happy for somebody winning. And I think that's the attitude, because we have a lot of people in the game who don't know how to lose and don't know how to be happy for other people. We understand, you know, it's a big investment. It's not like just willy nilly. You can't just go cook a contest for a couple $100 anymore. A lot of people have $500 to $1,000 invested, whether there's 30 people at a contest or there's 100 people at a contest. And so we understand, especially now too, you know, all the prices are up on everything. So we know what the investment is, but we also understand too, is like Tim's a guy who's got an open door policy. A lot of people don't know that. If he's cooking at a contest, he's not going to be a guy who's going to go out there and try to grab everybody and shake their hand and everything else. But if you come up to Tim, he'll talk to you all day long. If he comes, there's a lot of people who they're right in the middle of turning something in and they're going to go, no, you just wait. I'll talk to you when we're done. He doesn't do that. He's just like super open door policy. You want to come check out, see what he's doing. He doesn't have any secrets as far as that goes. So it's kind of one of those things that, again, that's the way my mentality is as well. I'm more than happy to explain anything to anybody anytime. If I have it and I don't need it, you're more than welcome to borrow it. And I think that's really how this barbecue thing needs to be. So it's a barbecue family. I respect every brand out there. Luckily for us now with Blues Hog, Gateway, everything else, somebody uses one piece of our puzzle. So they use our seasoning, or they use our sauce, or they use our charcoal, or they use, you know, a gateway drum. So every event that we go to, there's not a camp that I can't go walk into and say, hey, thanks for being a customer. Because we know, even if they don't have that bottle out, I know that they're using that product somewhere. But again, but that's the respect that he's built in this industry, that everyone respects what he does. And you talk about the gateway drum smokers. If you go to any of these big contests, 50% of the drums that are going to be there are all going to be gateways. And there's tons of off brands. Tim does have a patent. He could be a jerk and he could go around and sue everybody for copying his design, but he doesn't. There's some people, they push his buttons a little bit, he might. But I mean, for the most part, people use this particular brand of cooker because of the way that it cooks. He has actually physically come up with something that you cannot replicate that flavor on any other situation. And it's a combination of the charcoal and the way the basket's made and the way that it creates a vortex of heat inside the drum, mm-hmm. but they work. And the other thing is the advantage of using a drum over any other product is you can cook a brisket in 5 hours. You can cook pork ribs in 3 hours. You can cook a chicken in an hour and a half. You can cook pork butt in 4 hours. It cuts down the time on everything. So all of a sudden, you're not a 225 cooker anymore. Like everyone grew up and go, oh, if you're going to smoke, you got to cook at 225. These things run at like 300 degrees all day long. And what he says is the sizzle. You got to listen for the sizzle. And what happens is when you put that protein on that grill, that's the first thing you're going to hear is that sizzle. And when you know that you have that right off the bat, that's what you're going to have the entire time. And it's crazy. You can run them, no deflectors in there. It's just running straight over charcoal, dripping grease right over that fire. And that's what creates that flavor that is so, so hard to replicate. But that's the advantage of using a drum and what makes them special and how it all kind of came up. You know, we just went and did an event in Kansas City. Kansas City is part of these Q events. So there's a guy down in St. Louis, Missouri. His name is Brian Wabi. And Brian has put on these Q events for, I don't know, years. So they're barbecue festivals. He brings in 12 pit masters. They all cook for the public. He sells whatever. People come through. We may serve 30,000 people in a weekend type of deal. And he just tries to change it up. And we go to different areas. We did Kansas City. We're fixing to do Denver next month. And then we'll do St. Louis. And then we'll have wind up the year down in Florida, the very last event. We needed kind of a gimmick for these festivals, you know, something to draw the crowd. Not only were we bringing our world championship pork shoulder to this event, but we needed something else. One of the things is right after Memphis in May, we had a conversation. We go, all right, well, now you won shoulder. Now you're going to have to come back and beat Myron at Whole Hog. And he goes, yep. He said, that's what we're going to have to do. And I said, yeah. I said, we're probably going to have to build this big, gigantic drum smoker to be able to cook a whole hog in. He goes, yeah, I think we do. And sure enough, when we went to Denver or to Kansas, rather, he goes, hey, we're going to be cooking whole hog. I was like, okay. I said, how are we going to cook whole hog? And we actually have a big old hickory, you know, kind of a commercial pit on one of our trailers, event trailers. I said, oh, okay, we're just going to cook it in the old hickory. He goes, nope. So we're going to cook it on a drum. I was like, how are we going to do that? We're going to cut it up, put it in drum, hang it in a drum. How are we going to do that? He said, nope, building one. I said, okay. And sure enough, we show up. He sent me some pictures right before Kansas City. It's kind of the same deal. It's that Tim Shear mentality that we get there. He opens it up and it's 5 foot across. It's like almost like 4.5 feet tall. I mean, it's a monster. And it's got a winch on it to be able to open and close the lid. And so he gets there, hooks it up to power, opens up the lid. And I'm like, dude, this is like brand new. Yep. He said, we just got finished painting it right before we brought it over here.
Wow.
I'm like, okay. And I said, so how's this thing going to cook? He's, I have no idea. I said, but I think it's going to work. And sure enough, we actually put in four baskets like we normally do in our regular drum. And this, our normal drums just have two stacks that actually bring our cold air in, one exhaust out. This drum he built, he put four stacks on it to bring in fresh air, one big stack to let smoke out. And we basically put one basket in front of each one of those intakes, four baskets total, one whole hog, 5 hours. Ridiculous.
Wow.
And it probably turned out to be the very first hog that we cooked on there turned out so, so, so good. That thing is going to Memphis in May next year, and we are going to chase hog next year. But I tell you what, is go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at the Gateway Drum Smokers website.
Yep.
And I'm looking at the drum smokers, and they are unique. I got to say, they are unique, yes. But not just that. They're bold.
Yes.
I mean, the color just pops.
Yes.
I mean, you can get anyone, and they're really unique. And I can tell going to the shop tab that obviously you have the relationship with Blues Hog because it's all the products are there. Mm-hmm. So it was really, I would suggest to people if listening to this should check this out because it's something I have never seen before. It was really cool.
So for a lot of people who don't understand what a drum smoker is, and you probably have a lot of this customer in your fan base, is, you know, if people are familiar with Kamado Joe, Green Egg, Kamado Joe, anything like that, ceramic cookers, it's basically a ceramic cooker that doesn't break. So you can take this anywhere, you can take it to the beach, you can take it hunting, you can take it camping, you can do whatever you want. This literally kind of cooks the same way, kind of the same theory on here. But again, it gives it a really, really great flavor. So people who look at this thing and go, I don't compete. You know, what's this going to do for me? Well, we actually have like rib hangers on there. So you could actually cook for a whole crowd. You could hang like 14. I've done it. You can hang 14 racks of ribs in there at one time. And I actually did that for a video. And I just add some video. Nobody's going to taste it. And it actually turned out really, really good. And you just hang the ribs in there and you let them go. And 3 hours later, they were done. You didn't quite have the color on them that you can, you know, if you do individual ones and take a little bit more care. But it was a great product. Same thing, you know, you can squeeze in, like, you could literally put four pork butts on there. Chickens. It just kind of depends on how you like your chickens. You're doing quarters or whatever. You can put multiple racks in there and you can cook a ton of stuff. Sometimes people look at these and go, well, I don't know if that's the right fit for me because I just want it for my backyard. I've got a ton of backyard people who love this grill. And that's the number one reason is because it's versatile. It's not going to break. And like I said, you can do it. You can take this thing anywhere you want. I've got drums today, which I just picked up earlier, is we're having an IBCA meeting this weekend. And because I'm in Texas and our offices are up in Missouri, I can't always have like brand new stuff here all the time. For this meeting, I wanted to have some Gateway drums there that look good. And so I actually took some old ones that we had that were actually, I've been cooking on for like 2 years, beat up. I mean, just looked terrible. And I went sandblasting them. I have a friend of mine who's got a powder coat company here in town. He just powder coated them for me. Went and put them together this afternoon. And they are like brand new. And that's one of the advantages, too, with these is you can change up the colors. You can do, you know, whatever. They're easy to repair. As long as you don't let the things rust out, these things will last forever. And there's actually no reason to let them rust out. There's no, unless you literally leave the lids open when it rains, that's the only way that you ever get moisture in there. But again, like I said, is the versatility on these things is crazy. A lot of these guys like to be custom. So they'll get custom paint jobs and all this other stuff. Like me, I love powder coat, but they're easy to clean. I go to a lot of events. I have to make sure that my equipment looks good every time I go. So pretty much like one will last me like a whole year looking good. And then eventually I just got to get it cleaned up. But they're a ton of fun to cook on. Where are y'all at in New York?
We're on Long Island.
Oh, are you really?
Okay. Yeah. And there's not. I'm looking for a deal in Eros, and I can't find any.
No, it's actually Ace Hardware. You can get those through Ace Hardware, and they will drop ship to a store.
And I'm just going to say, Tim Shear is a genius.
He is.
I'm just going to say it.
He is. I tell you what, I know a lot of guys in the industry. I've never met anyone like Tim Scheer who's optimistic about literally everything and not scared to take on something. You know, because there's a lot of people who just he's not afraid to jump. Just put it that way. And if he thinks that there's something that's going to be successful or something that's going to be a real tool that's going to benefit people, he's going to do it. And that's what happens is, you know, sometimes you walk into like these barbecue specialty stores and 50% of the products that are in that store, you'll never use. Somebody may go in there and buy it for you for Father's Day or, you know, it's one of those gifts that you get and you're like, oh, great. Another tie.
It was in the garage.
Exactly. You know, and it's those things that go on the hook in the garage and it never moves. Right. And everything that Tim has ever made, developed, anything like that, it's 100% useful. And that's kind of one of the deals for us is when I walk into a new dealer and they go, oh, well, tell me the product that I shouldn't get. And I'm like, well, there's really not one. There's some seasonings that do better in some regional areas than others. But to be real honest, like for us now, here in Texas, we have the ability to cook Texas style, KCBS style. We have literal contests now that you can go on one side of the street, they're cooking Texas style. The other side of the street, they're cooking KCBS styles. And they're looking for those flavor profiles. So they fit, you know. But the good thing is all of our flavor profiles will fall into either category now because a lot of people have adapted KCBS to bring into the Texas barbecue. So they're kind of melded into each other now. The big difference for us between cooking Texas and KCBS or any other sanctioning body is pork butt. They don't do Texas. IBCA doesn't do pork butt. They used to, but there's a new organization that just started called CBA, Champions Barbecue Association, or Alliance rather. And what they did was, is they brought in like all the best parts of Texas barbecue, plus the KCBS styles into one event. Because what's happened for a long, long time is if you do extremely well in Texas barbecue and you achieve everything that you can possibly achieve and you get an opportunity to go cook the Jack or the American Royal or any of these other deals, if you don't know how to cook a pork butt, you may cook everything else perfect and the pork butt will kill you. And right. So IBCA stood on for a long time that they didn't want to have that in there as an extra category. But it did a lot of the cooks a disservice because it was not preparing them for the opportunity to get out and go cook outside of Texas. And what's happened over the last probably, I'm going to say 5 years, is you're starting to see more and more competitive cooks in Texas who cook outside of Texas like 50% of the time now. Because people understand you can be a hero in Texas. You can be the best cook in Texas, but if you don't ever leave Texas, nobody outside of Texas knows who you are. So there's no opportunity to become that Myron Mixon or to become that Mo Kayson or to become that Chris Lilly or Tuffy Stone or anything like that. There's been very few guys in Texas who have that type of recognition. Now, there are some guys like Ernest Cervantes. You have Fred Robles happened to be, he won the American Royal in 19. That's a guy who got out of his comfort zone and cooked every state. He's actually physically said, I want to cook in every state in the United States, just so I understand how it is. But he's a winner. He's done extremely well. He's won world food championships. He's won, I don't even know. I mean, he's been recognized in every major event out there. But for me, I'm Hispanic, so I'm proud. He's the first Hispanic to ever win the American Royal, which is a big thing for us. But it kind of set the standard as well. There's so many Texas cooks now go, if he can do it, I can do it. So you're starting to see more and more Texas cooks get out there, get out of their comfort zone. It's crazy now that you go to a lot of these newer cooks, bigger events now. And I mean, there's in every spot that you see, I mean, there's $100,000 sitting there. There's an RV, there's a big trailer, there's all this other stuff for people to go and chase plastic trophies and ribbons at these events. There's very, very few people who can make a living out of competitive barbecue. There are guys who do it. There's very, very few guys who can do that. you got to work extremely hard at all your other jobs in order to pay for this. This is a very, very expensive hobby.
But yeah, I got to get Len out of his comfort zone. I got to get him off Long Island.
There you go. Come on. I tell you what, it's when we were in New York, we had a couple of different places that we were going to go and eat while we were there. James Cruz he's like phenomenal at lining up like all these different restaurants and, you know, people to go see and everything else. And now I feel terrible because I can't remember what the name of the place was now, but there is a kosher barbecue.
Oh yes. I know who you're talking about.
He's going to kill me because I can't remember his name right now. But anyways, so.
Well, I know there's one in Chicago called Milt's.
Oh,
Milt's Barbecue for the Perplexed. Brian Greek
is. But this is
in New York. I know.
Yeah, oh, in New York. I mean, can't remember the name of it.
Izzy's.
Yes, Izzy's. Yes.
Izzy's.
Yeah, he won a rib competition.
Yes.
Making beef ribs.
At Pig Beach. James tells me, he goes, hey, man, he goes, we're going to go eat barbecue. And I'm always like, ah, you know, barbecue. So anyways, so we go and he goes, yeah, we're going to meet this guy. And, you know, and I'd heard about it, never really did anything. You know, I go to like Blue Smoke and, you know, I go see Billy Durney. And, mm-hmm. you know, when I go to New York, I got my spots that I go hit. And I actually had never been. So we go over there. My expectations were not super high. We walk in there and, of course, it's very Hasidic there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not what I would expect at all from that neighborhood. And I was trying to figure out, I was like, how were all these people eating barbecue? I just didn't think that happened. And so he kind of explained all the process and, you know, how he made it happen. And so he brings this, Izzy actually brings this platter and he sets it down. And it's like the most beautiful barbecue platter I've ever seen. And I probably take 200-300 pictures of barbecue platters like a year. I mean, I've seen them all. And this one is, I swear to you, was the most beautiful one that I've ever seen. And every single cut of meat, every his coleslaw, his pickles, everything on that plate was amazing. I don't think I've had better barbecue, to be very honest. My best barbecue, and I'll tell you right now, there's a place in Austin, Texas, in Manshack, Texas, actually. It's called Valentina's. He, to me, is like my favorite barbecue. He's a good friend, Miguel, but that is like my favorite barbecue. I'll tell everybody that. But I tell you, this barbecue was just, it was so phenomenal. If anybody has not been there, they need to go. Doesn't matter what it costs. Doesn't matter how long you got to wait. Got to eat at that spot. Izzy also next door owns a coffee shop or coffee and pastry shop, which is also amazing. I think James and I bought like, I don't know, like $50, $60 worth of pastries. And I ate every single one of them. Oh, I mean, wow. It was ridiculous. Over a course of 2 days, I ate everything. Usually, I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. Every time that I go to New York, it's Italian food is like my number one thing. That's what I want to go have every single time I go. But like I said, this was probably my best food experience I've ever had in New York was there at Izzy's.
In New York, $50, $60 for pastry. Maybe you buy two.
No, it wasn't that
you know,
bad.
The prices are...
It was. Honestly, we got two boxes. Because wow. we were there that particular day that we were there. We actually had to go back to Jersey to go and cook. There's a guy there that it's called Brothers Barbecue. And they actually had a pit coming up from Texas that we were going to cook on. Because, of course, with all the craziness going on, we couldn't have a pit on site that we couldn't cook there at Pig Beach. So we literally had to find a kitchen and everything else way off site. Cooked over there, cooked all night long. And then I think that we got to the event like an hour before everything started to kind of get it all cranked up again.
So you're cooking on an unknown pit. You've never cooked on this pit. And that's a bit, wow.
We were the very first ones. So there's a guy who's actually from where I live right now. I'm in a small town outside of San Antonio, Texas. There's another town that's called Luling, Texas, which is kind of like one of the barbecue capitals of Texas. You know, it's been around a long time. Old oil field company or town rather. So there's a guy there that started building pits like 2 years ago. They're Syntex. The guy's name is Michael Johnson. Great guy. Somebody took to him the idea because they knew he's been in the oil field building pipe and all kinds of stuff for years and years. Somebody went to them and said, hey, you know, can you build me a barbecue pit? And he's like, yeah, I pretty much build anything. You know, he's a welder, can do anything they want. So a guy brought him this idea. He goes, this is how I want this pit. And he explained all these details to him. It wound up the guy built the pit. The guy came and picked up the pit, took it home, cooked on it. And it's a 1,000-gallon pit. So it's like 20 feet long. You know, you put 40, 50 briskets on it at one time, whatever. And so the guy goes, takes it home, cooks on it, comes back and goes, you know what? That pit cooks amazing from the inch number one on this side to inch number 4,000 on this side. So he literally, like the very first one that he built for this craft barbecue, he built like perfectly. So he built a reputation for himself very, very, in a very short time, where you have a lot of other guys, pit builders who've been doing it for 10 years, you know, who finally got down here. You have guys who are on like 2-3 year waiting lists to have one of these $20,000 pits built, stuff like that. So anyways, this guy got a little footing in there. He happened to build this particular guy in Houston, his pit, Ronnie Killen. At that time, Mo Kayson was spending time with Ronnie. Mo sees his pit and he goes, oh man, I love that pit. I want a pit like that. Mo ordered one from Michael, which was his second pit that he built, and it turned out phenomenal. And then he built this other pit. This happened to be the one that got sent up to these guys, two brothers. So it showed up. We beat the pit there. I think we were an hour before the pit got there. And as soon as the pit got there, I actually had taken up like half a quart of wood from Texas because we want to cook on the wood that we cook on down here. And so sure enough, I got up there, fired up the pit, kind of usually you want to let it burn for hours and cure it and oil it and all. Well, we didn't. We burned it for an hour and we threw meat in it. We literally had no time to really mess with it that much. It cooked perfectly, did exactly what we needed it to do. And it just a testament of being a barbecue cook. One of the biggest things is the ability to adapt to whatever you're going to cook on and figure it out in a pretty short period of time. So that's been one of the nice things is I literally have, I don't know, 20, I've probably got 20 pits here at my house from every extremity that you can imagine. So, I mean, I've had the pleasure of cooking on every single type of pit out there. And for me to just look at something, go, okay, yeah, well, this is how we're going to do it. We can pretty much do that. It just so happened that, like I said, I had a relationship with this guy, told him we're going to New York, needed a pit to cook on. He's like, yeah, no problem. Usually if I'd go up there, I'd borrow one from Billy Durney or somebody like that. So anyways, it all worked out. Luckily, like I said, it's having great equipment, having great wood, having great proteins to cook. That's what makes barbecue successful. And like I said, is the understanding of barbecue for me is being able to do something for someone. My thing is I just want to see the smile on somebody's face at the end of the day. So if I can make you happy with whatever I cooked you, that's all I need out of the deal. I'm not about chasing awards and chasing trophies and stuff like that. I'm like way past that stage. That's all we're interested in now is right, making people happy.
Well, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Well, and you actually, Joey, not only do you make people happy, but you're living you have a quote on your Facebook page that I love. Doing what I love because I love what I do. Yeah. And I think that says it all.
Joe, you spoke about your social media. Could you tell us where people can contact you? What social media you have out there? Any sure. Websites? Anything you want to promote, please? Floor yeah.
So I'm pretty simple. I have my original competition name was Guadalupe Barbecue Company. So I have a page as Guadalupe Barbecue Company. I have a page that's just under Joey Machado. I discovered TikTok over this little hiatus that we've had, and I fell in love with TikTok. So have done a lot of stuff on there. I've got a page, it's called Texas Fire. That app has introduced me to so many new people that I never knew in barbecue. So many talented people who just got on there and just like I did, just were trying to kill time and started doing recipes and all kinds of stuff. So anyone who doesn't have it, I would suggest, you know, take a look at it. If you look for barbecue stuff, you're going to find barbecue stuff. If you want to find silly cats, you're going to find silly cats. There's a lot of cool people out there. We do the same thing as far as Twitter. And then, of course, we're associated to another piece of our companies. It's called The Barbecue League. So The Barbecue League, we have a website, we have Facebook, we have, you know, you name it, we have everything. The website that we have, it's actually a paid subscription service. So what we've done is, because of all my relationships in barbecue across the world, we've actually gone and spent time with all these great pit masters, and we've gotten recipes, and we've gotten, you know, how to's, and we've got everything. I've even got Tim putting out everything that you need to know about how he cooks. And he is actually one of the most simple cooks in the world.
What a genius.
Yes.
Let's not leave that out.
Exactly. And so we have this thing, it's called Barbecue League. You can go on there and you can actually just, you can look for recipes that you're looking for. You can become a member and have access to every single thing. When we go to big events like Memphis in May and the Royal and stuff like that, we actually will have the league lounges. So if you're a member of our subscription group, you can come hang out with us, hang out with all of our cooks. We introduce you to everybody who's, you know, part of our group. And of course, we'll do one-on-ones with anybody. If we're in an event like that and you want to come help us or you want to do anything like that, you just come on board, come hang out with us. But that's kind of our main deal. You know, we're very, very focused on what we do, but we understand that we can't do it if we don't have the people who love barbecue. Right. And so that's what we do it for at the end of the day, is the people who love barbecue.
We love barbecue. And Joey, I think that this interview, we've loved this interview. This is really, you've been fantastic.
Well, I appreciate it. Sometimes it's hard for me to shut up.
No, that's my problem with Len, but no, you are great.
Well, we need to figure out a time when I can get back to New York. I'd love to come up and cook with y'all.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I'll cook for you one day, but then we have to go eat all the rest of the days.
You got it. And we have a couple pretty good barbecue restaurants here as well. So
glad we don't necessarily have to go eat barbecue.
Okay.
We've got very good Italian. Yeah.
That's it. Now you're talking my language.
Yeah, we definitely do.
And might have to go to Lombardi's. I got to go to Lombardi's every time I go.
And we could go to Katz's.
Yes, and I love Katz's.
Right. Meathead says that Katz's is the... what does he say? It's the longest running
barbecue
place.
Yeah. Exactly. I love the pastrami. And that's the deal, is if you go to Izzy's, you got to have his pastrami.
Oh, yeah.
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 Well, Joey, thank you very much. And we will speak to you again.
Thank you so much.
And we want to thank Joey for joining us on Baseball and BBQ. He represents Blue Dog and the Gateway Drum Smokers again. So check them out. Thank you, Joey.
And all I'm going to say is Tim Shear is a genius.
Yeah, you said that before.
Yes. All right. So, Jeff.
Yes, sir.
We are now in between episodes.
Yes.
Is there something you want to ask me?
What did you do at Yankee Stadium?
Did I go to Yankee Stadium? I did. Jeff, I had the opportunity to go to Yankee Stadium for a special day. Hartford Insurance had us at the stadium as their guests. It was very nice. It was a great day. Started, I think, 10:30, and we're all sitting there. We're in the Ford dining hall, or Ford, sponsored by Ford. And we're sitting there, and we're at tables, and all of a sudden, there's a familiar voice, none other than Paul Olden, and he introduces Tino Martinez and Mariano Rivera. And in they come, and there was a question and answer session with them, and then autographs. And Jeff, when we were lined up for autographs, I'm thinking to myself, they gave us two baseballs. And I said, do I just get these autographed and keep my mouth shut and walk on? Or do I I guess what would be the, I don't even know, you know, just aggressive and just ask them to be on the show. And then people in front of me are asking them questions and stuff. So I said, you know what? What do I have to lose? So I get Tino Martinez and I start talking to him and asking him if he ever does podcasts and would he like to come on the show? And we'll see what happens. But I mentioned baseball and barbecue. And then I said to Mariano Rivera, the great Mariano Rivera, I asked him if he ever did podcasts. And they said occasionally. And I asked him as well. Then we move on. And there was a photo session where they stand there and you stand in between them. And I walked over and I stood between them. And they said, hey, barbecue guy. So now I'm barbecue guy. Later on, we had a session in the batting cage. And Tino Martinez is there and he's giving instructions. Jeff, it's been years since I swung a bat. Years. Tino Martinez is there. And I afterwards said to him, that's why I talk about baseball and I don't play it. And then later, I had a catch with Mariano Rivera in the visitors' bullpen. I was actually having a catch with Mariano. And, you know, I said to him, I said, Mariano, I can make you a good brisket. He walked over and he said, you were okay, you know, throwing the baseball, which I was not. I said, pulled pork, ribs, brisket. I can make that much better than I can throw a ball. And he said, that sounds really good. In the meantime, we are still waiting for them to come on.
Yeah. And I think we'll be waiting and waiting.
But there is one more thing to the story. And then I'm going to mention the other thing. Paul Olden. And for those of you who listen to The Fan and have heard updates, and I believe he's also the public address announcer at Yankee Stadium. I heard that voice and it was just so distinctive.
For those who don't know, The Fan is WFAN radio in New York.
Sorry. Yeah. I shouldn't assume that everybody knows that. Right. And I mentioned it. We had just spoken the night before to Tim Neverett, who we're going to have next. And Paul Olden says to me, oh, Tim's a friend of mine. And it was just, we start talking about that. And hopefully we will be having Paul Olden on the show as well. So it was an exciting day, Jeff. It really was. And we're going to get into that interview. But before we do, let us mention a few of our very good friends of the show. BaseballBBQ.com for incredible grilling tools and accessories. The Pandemic Baseball Book Club, which many of the authors that we have on this show are from. Go to their website and you can buy their books, buy some swag, and of course, fifthandcherry.com for cutting boards that you will just, they're works of art. And with that, Jeff, jump in because I've done a lot of talking.
Here's Tim Neverett with COVID Curveball, the story of the 2020 Los Angeles Dodgers. Baseball in 2020, what a weird, wacky 60-game season. From COVID rules, some of which will be permanently implemented, to COVID outbreaks on the Marlins and Cardinals, social unrest causing games to be postponed, to expanded playoffs. COVID really threw a curveball to the 2020 baseball season. And what an appropriate name for a new book. COVID Curveball, an inside view of the 2020 Los Angeles Dodgers World Championship season by our guest, Tim Neverett. Tim is a veteran sports play-by-play announcer and reporter. He has covered the Boston Red Sox, Pittsburgh Pirates, along with college football, basketball, hockey, and the Olympics. Today, he does play-by-play and pre- and post-game hosting duties for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He is with us to talk about this fascinating new look into the 2020 Dodgers season. Welcome to Baseball and BBQ, Tim Neverett.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We appreciate you coming on. So, Tim, first I want to say I've always wanted to go to spring training for my favorite team, the Mets. Never got the chance. However, my son attends Arizona State University. So I did go out to see him in February 2020 and took him several spring training sites. And I have to say the Dodgers facility at Camelback Ranch is just, as Larry David would say, pretty, pretty, pretty good. I know they share it with the White Sox, but it's a terrific facility.
Yeah, it is. It's one of the better ones for sure. I think it's right up there with Diamondbacks and Rockies over in Scottsdale. They're at Talking Stick. They've got pretty good facility too, but certainly Camelback Ranch has everything. It was custom designed. You know, the White Sox got their side of it and they designed it the way they wanted it. The Dodgers got their side of it, designed it the way they wanted it. A river, man-made river separates the two. And it's just a beautiful thing. And brought some things from Vero Beach. There are some grapefruit trees that they brought from Florida that grow right outside the Dodger clubhouse. So they've got some really neat touches there. And we didn't get to go this year in 2021. The broadcasters did not get to go to spring training. I missed it terribly. And I'm hoping we get to go next year because that was the first time I had never not gone to spring training.
Right. So what was your motivation writing the 2020 season? Obviously you didn't know when you were writing it that the Dodgers would win the World Series, but you knew they were a loaded team.
Knew they were good. Had no idea they'd win the World Series. In fact, I had no idea we'd even play a season at one point. And so after things were shut down and I went back home, my wife and I decided to go to the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and we got a cabin up there, and we just, basically spent time away from humanity for about a month and a half while we were quarantining. While up there, just kind of decided that it would be a good idea to write something, just journal something. I never really set out and had the intention of saying, yeah, we're going to write a book on the World Series winning season, you know, because the season hadn't started. We didn't know what the rules were going to be, how many games. I just thought, because my schedule was up in the air at that point, because typically I do a lot of the games on radio, a good portion of the games on television, and a handful of times I'll anchor from the studio. So I have a pretty busy season. I didn't know if I'd have any season, but I said, you know, I'm just going to figure this out as we go and just kind of write every day and journaled it. And as we went along, I wrote it in real time. So I did it every day. I caught up from the first part of spring training to quarantine while in quarantine, because frankly, there wasn't a lot to do. So I went after my memory banks and wrote some stuff down. And then from there, I did every day and came up with COVID curveball. And you know, there's a lot of different stories that are in there that are relevant to baseball, but you know, it's kind of offshoots of what we were talking about at the time of that day. Tried to tie in some of my own stories, and it's just a different view of how, you know, the Dodgers went about their business and trying to stay healthy enough to win a World Series, and how we had to stay healthy enough and totally adjust how we broadcast games. It was just totally weird. It's kind of the bizarro world of baseball last year. And some of it is normal this year. And for us, as broadcasters, it's still not at all. So we're hopeful that 2022 will finally be able to get back to what we've been accustomed to for the last several decades in baseball.
The book is COVID Curveball, an inside view of the 2020 Los Angeles Dodgers World Championship season. We are talking to Tim Neverett, and I am trying to use as best a broadcasting voice as I can, because I have to say, Jeff, we don't often have someone on with pipes like Tim Neverett. You know, we have to like kind of go a little deeper as we talk. And Tim, this is the part of the show where I fawn a little bit. This book is fantastic.
Thank you.
The way you write it as the journal, and we get to live every day, and it's not just what happened in the game. It's the little nuances. You write what's going on around. You talk about COVID testing. And, you know, when this whole season was happening, I was basically working from home at my dining room table. And this was, you know, this was the season. And it's just so fascinating to read about it from someone who, you know, lived it in that way. You lived in a 22nd story of a hotel in Los Angeles. You went to an empty stadium to broadcast games because you didn't travel with the team. It's just fantastic. But now I got to ask you a question, right? This is the part where I have to ask you a question. So
right.
You write about, there's just so many things in here. You write about Emerson College, for instance. So you are an Emerson College alumni.
I am.
And what's great is you give back to the school. You teach at the school. And I know it doesn't have a lot to do with the book, but tell us a little bit about that and your class that you give at Emerson.
Well, yeah. In fact, a couple of nights ago, I was fine-tuning my syllabus. So, and I still have some more work to do before we begin the next semester. So it's going to be a pretty busy Tuesday for me. At the same time, I've been teaching some different courses, one in sports advocacy, one in sports public relations. And the school asked me last semester, they said, if you could design a course for our sports communications major, what would you do? And I said, well, that's easy. I said, upper level students, 400 level or better, and it would be sports broadcasting and all the nuances that go into it that no one ever thinks about. And I said, well, you know, when I went to Emerson, we never had anything like this. I looked around their course, you know, the courses, there's nothing like it anywhere. And basically they're going to learn how to do games. They're going to learn how to do talk shows. They're going to learn how to do interviews. They're going to learn how to do radio pregame, postgame, TV pregame, postgame. They're going to learn all the things that go into it, including the preparation. They're going to learn more about preparation than they will performance. But believe me, when they leave the class, they're going to have a clue on what it takes to be a sports broadcaster and what they need to do. So that's what I'm going to do this semester, and looking forward to doing that class. And the students are very good. They're very smart students there. They're very, very active students there. So what I've found is that teaching students at the college level, it's better, especially the upper level ones, because you can treat them like adults. You can tell them how it is and they can take it. So that's kind of the best part of it is, you know, the rewarding thing is later on when they get back to you and they say, hey, I got this internship or I got this job. I didn't know, think you were right, but actually, you know what? You were right. So that's what you want to hear. And I really enjoy sharing the knowledge and giving back the way that I do, because it's a unique opportunity. So I didn't want to turn down the opportunity, and I really enjoy doing it. I like the interaction with the students. You know, the school wants me to do it remotely. I'll do it from Los Angeles. The way we're talking now, for a little bit, I'll go back to Boston for about 2 months, do it in person there. And then, so, and they want me to take, if I have a game somewhere, they want me to take the students with me, basically, through my iPad, essentially. And I've taught the course from the Sportsnet LA studios. I've taught the course from Dodger Stadium, giving them the tour. Done it from a broadcast booth there. We've, you know, and I'm planning on doing some other things this year and taking them a lot of different places, not only around Boston, but around the country.
Sounds cool. How do I take that course?
You got to pay a lot of money.
Yeah, I'm sure. Getting back to baseball, when you were waiting for the season to begin, you know, you had March and then the season begins in late July. You had all that time really do nothing, but except for writing the book. But did you, when the negotiations were going on between MLB and the Players Association, did you have any inside knowledge? Did they tell you anything what was going on?
I got everything off of here, off of my phone. And it was, I became a Twitter-holic, I guess, because I'd get up in the morning, I'd be scrolling. I'd just scroll for news. If we got a little bit of news, I'd get it from there because the reporters, the national reporters had it before anybody. And there were a couple of times I got a phone call from the team. There was a couple of times we had some Zoom meetings with the broadcasters where I would get some inside information on what they were looking at, what the possibilities were. But for the most part, I was getting the word at the same time pretty much everybody else was.
Tim, you know, as I'm reading this book and learning about you, I think the reader will relate to you more. And I say that because you've really paid your dues. You know, you started broadcasting at a young age, but you did AAA games for like 10 years, and it doesn't appear that you've ever had anything handed to you. I think Jeff and I are trying to do things with this podcast that we wanted to do, and now we work regular jobs and we have this, but so I admire everything that you've done, and it's just, you're welcome. And as you read this, you feel that, you know, this is someone that really, even while this COVID season was happening and you were talking about, oh, I guess I'm not broadcasting this game, or, oh, I thought I was going to broadcast, I guess I'm sitting this one out, or at the end they sent me home, I almost felt bad, like, Tim's not going to do the playoffs and the series.
I watched it on the couch just like everybody else. That's just the way 2020 was. And you know, initially they told me I was going to do every game all the way through the World Series. And then that changed. And, you know, I'm in a position there where I just have to kind of roll with the punches. And I was lucky to, you know, there were a lot of people in my position that weren't employed last year. And there were a lot of major league broadcasters who worked for the television flagship or the radio flagship that weren't employed, that got cut. And while we remained employed, I thanked the Dodgers for that. And I was just in a position where, okay, whatever you want me to do. So they said, all right, look, we want you to do a segment on the pregame, segment on the postgame every day. We want you involved. We understand this is a one-off season, and you know, we're looking for you to be back next year in the more expanded role that we've got designed for you, which I am, which is great. I'm having a good time with it. But yeah, it was difficult because I didn't know for sure until the very last day of the season that I wasn't going to go to Arlington. In fact, the day before, I was told by somebody else in the front office that I was going to Arlington and going to be in the bubble. And then the 24 hours later, I got called into my boss's office expecting to be told I was going to Arlington. And they told me, you can go home if you want. I went, what? So, okay, that's what you want me to do. I'll go home and watch TV, I guess, which is what I did.
Tim, you have a section in the book that's pretty moving. It talks about the passing of your father. And baseball must have been a big part of your lives because you had a ball and you got this new ball. You have it autographed, but well, you all signed it and you put it in the casket with your dad. We just had the Field of Dreams game and we had some people on that were at the game. And, you know, part of that movie, the core or one of the themes of that movie is the catch with the father. Can you tell us about your remembrance of, having catches with your dad?
Yeah, I mean, it was from as early as I can remember. You know, my older brother is 6 years older than me, so he was always playing. He had a head start on me, so I, you know, as a youngster, I was always going to his games, sitting with my dad. And, you know, when I started playing in Little League, my brother was in, you know, like Babe Ruth or high school baseball, and we're constantly going to games. My dad went to so many games at the local stadium that they actually retired his seat, and they retired a seat next to him for my mother. So they have plaques with their names on them, and they gave our family the tickets for those seats, you know, like forever. So nobody else can ever sit there because he was just one of those guys that was always, you know, he was always at the ballpark. My brother coached at the high school level for 30 years. And then he coached the College Wood Bat League for another bunch of years. And my dad was at every game and he was at all my games. And it was not unusual for me to be at a practice, say in Little League or in junior high or in high school, and turn around and see my dad at practice or see his car parked up on the hill, knowing that he took off from work just to come over and just catch a little bit of the practice or a game or a scrimmage or something. He loved baseball. And then there were times when we first got cable television, it was great because Major League Baseball was totally unregulated at that point. And I was the human remote control. We didn't have a remote. We had a little slider right on top of the TV. So, we'd be watching the Red Sox. They'd go to commercial. You'd go, check PIX for the Yankees. Okay. Check OR for the Mets. All right. Well, let's see what the Expos are doing. So I'd go up to Canal Tres and I'd hear, Un Paul Dupriz or Warren Cromartie, whatever. So we'd watch the Expos in French. And then we'd go watch the Braves and we'd go watch the Cubs. And it was like back and forth all night long watching baseball in every possible game we could get, which came with our cable package. And we loved it. I did it all the time. I didn't mind getting a change of channels. I especially got really interested in all the National League games because I grew up in American League territory. And since 1973, we had the DH. But I loved watching the game with the pitcher in the lineup and the double switches and the different strategies. And, you know, the game that would dictate when the pitcher would come out, not when his arm's tired. So, then when I went and played American Legion, that's what we played. We played National League rules. We went from 7-inning games to 9-inning games. We had no DH and loved it. Anyway, we played other sports. We did other things, but it always came back to baseball in my family, especially with my dad and my mom too. She loved it. She watched baseball every night. When I got the Red Sox job and came home, well, when I got the Pirates job, I got them the MLB package so they could watch our games, and they did. When I came home for the Red Sox, they would watch the game and turn the sound down, turn the radio up and listen to me. You know, it was kind of a big deal. It was a real big deal for them. And I really appreciated everything they did for me.
Tim, we're spoiled in New York. We have Gary Cohen, Ron Darling, Keith Hernandez, and we kind of know where they live. They live in Connecticut, or Keith out in Sag Harbor. They would come to the stadium during 2020 and do the broadcast from the stadium, from the booth. You stayed in the hotel, but one of your broadcast partners had an unusual abode for the season. Rick Monday, could you tell us about that? That was a great tidbit in the book, by the way. That was fantastic.
Yeah, that was our best kept secret, because we were not allowed to say where he was. And he actually stayed there the first half of this year until we started allowing a full stadium of fans. He tried that for a little while, and people were wondering what this RV was doing in the parking lot, and why was Rick Monday hanging around this RV? So, yeah, he lived in an RV he borrowed from a friend who had it in storage, doing nothing. He parked it in Wadi at Dodger Stadium. There are trees around it. It's a little sliver of a lot. There are trees around it. The perfect campground kind of lot. And the Dodgers were like, yeah, bring it on. So they ran water lines to him. They ran electricity to him. They ran internet to him. Anything that he needed, they ran it right through a side gate, right up to the side of the RV. And he had a car, so if he had to go anywhere, he'd use the car. There were nights when, again, there's nobody at the stadium, right? So if we had a 2-hour, 30-minute game, he'd go, oh, I got a couple of Coronas out there. You want to come down? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. It was just down the stairs from where I'd park. So we'd hang out. I used to call it Moe's Bar and Grill. We'd hang out at Moe's Bar and Grill. He had a TV on the outside. He had like a fake fireplace inside. This thing was tricked out. But we kept it as a secret for about, you know, really a year and a half. And when the Dodgers went over the manuscript, they only came back with one problem that they had. And I said, well, what's that? They said, we don't want you telling anybody where Rick lives. I said, he's leaving. The people need the RV back. By the time anybody finds out that, or anybody reads this book, he's going to be long gone out of there. So they're like, are you sure? I said, I've talked to him 5 times about it. He said, yes, put it in the book. They came, they got the RV. He now goes back to where he normally was living in LA for many years. And it was kind of a neat deal, because when people would ask us, well, who's in that RV? You know, we'd have to go like, I don't know, somebody's in there. But there were all kinds of things. Coyotes would come up to his door. Raccoons would come up to his door. The sprinkler would go off at 4:30 in the morning and hit the side of the RV and wake him up. I mean, he really kind of roughed it, I guess. But that's kind of a funny thing and an endearing thing about him. He loved being out there and living in the parking lot at Dodger Stadium.
Talk about a short commute to work.
literally up a set of stairs and through a gate, and he's there.
Can you describe what you're broadcasting? You were broadcasting in an unusual place in Dodger Stadium, a luxury suite. It's a different setup from your broadcast booth. So how did you get used to that?
You just do, I guess. I mean, we go to so many places over the course of your career. I did a game one time from the top of a school bus, so this was not bad compared to that. But we're in a luxury suite, and that sounds really nice, but you have to broadcast from there. I had the front row. Whether I was broadcasting or not, I was there every night in the front row, and they were home. And I had a plastic Pelican case. If you're familiar with like an equipment case, it's made by a company called Pelican. It's just plastic. That was in the seat next to me. And that's where I had a lot of my paperwork. So it was like a makeshift desk. And then we had a little tiny bar top that was only about this thick. And we put a TV monitor on that. I had like an iPad on there, and that's how I watch the games. I mean, I just basically nestled into this little area, and there's a picture of it in the book, kind of where I'm sitting in front of this glass in front of me. Rick is 3 rows behind me at a bar table, with like a little living room lamp next to him. And so he's back there, and our producer, Dwayne McDonald, is sitting back in the suite, and we're all very socially distanced. And then when we did television, because of all the cabling and the lighting grid and everything else, they couldn't really move us out of the TV booth. So when I was in there with Oral Hershiser, we made sure that we sat 5 feet, 11 inches apart, exactly 5'11". I don't know what we sat apart, but it probably wasn't 6 feet, but we really couldn't move out of the booth, and we did the best we could.
Tim, the whole time that you were this whole season, did you never go home?
No, I stayed at the Westin Bonaventure. Normally I have an apartment, but because we had such a short season, I never booked one. So I never rented one. So I ended up staying in a suite at the hotel. I knew the manager there, and I told him what I was doing, and he goes, yeah, we'll give you an upgrade. So I had a nice, you know, a nice setup. It wasn't bad. except when the earthquake hit the one day and the tower started swaying like this. And I was like, oh my goodness. I've done earthquakes before, but not from the 22nd floor. It was a little bit unnerving. Yeah. So I was there the whole time and that was that. And then when it was time to go home, I just packed it up and got on a plane.
What's the bill for the hotel for all that time? Is that on you?
Well, fortunately, part of my deal was that they were going to pay for my housing for 2 years. They kind of got off easy because it was not the whole season. So, but it still counts. So, so anyway, yeah. So I didn't have to do that. But I have an apartment that I lease in downtown LA, and I'm actually going to be probably moving in there more on a full time basis in the winter.
Nice. Let's get into the season. The Dodgers are full of superstars. Clayton Kershaw, Cody Bellinger, Justin Turner.
Mookie Betts.
Who still haunts the Mets. And, of course, Mookie Betts. And they all came together in 2020. But it's not just not as a team, but going above and beyond, keeping safe during the COVID and protocols. Could you describe what they actually did? Because I know, well, the Cardinals and Marlins weren't exactly safe, but the Dodgers really went above and beyond.
They did. And, you know, the guy behind it was Justin Turner. And, you know, he went to the manager, Dave Roberts, and said, you know, Major League Baseball's protocols are good, but we think we have a chance to win. And in order to win, we have to stay healthy. We can't miss games. We can't have guys missing games. So above, over and above, like if you were, what they did was the offensive coaches, like the hitting coaches, if the team was in the field, they had to leave the dugout. So they would have fewer people in the dugout. If, you know, your base coaches, they're out there, but you know, you've got infield, outfield. So they're defensive coaches. So they're in the dugout when the team's at bat two, but they had pitchers sitting well outside the dugout, guys who weren't pitching that night. They had a whole other area where people could spread out and sit in the stands. And so they really spread out in the dugout. They stopped, you know, doing handshakes. They wanted to wear masks more often. I mean, nobody really wanted to wear masks more often, but they did because they felt they had to. But Justin Turner was really the ringleader on this. And that's why, and I had this conversation with him the other day, you know, when I hand delivered him the book and I said, you know, you're in here a couple of times, so you may want to know. But I said, it was ironic. I found it ironic that he was the COVID cop, yet he was the guy who got the positive test.
Right.
He was completely asymptomatic. He never felt sick, never felt a sniffle. But somehow he had a positive test during game six of the World Series. And as I wrote in the book, and I still maintain, the most 2020 thing about 2020 was that Blake Snell, pitching for the Rays, was dominating. And due to analytics and team philosophy, he didn't last as long as a game as a guy with COVID-19.
Right.
So that, to me, was the most 2020 thing about the entire season.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that with Blake Snell coming out. I think Mookie was just, he loved that when he came out. I mean, how could, you know, that's going to really go with Kevin Cash for the rest of his managerial career, taking him out. I mean, the guy was cruising.
It will, but that's an organizational philosophy in Tampa Bay. It got him to game six of the World Series. So it works to a point. However, this is still baseball, still a game played by human beings, and there's still the eye test.
Right.
And a manager still has to have a gut. Mm-hmm. As soon as he took him out, six pitches later, the Dodgers had the lead in the World Series in hand. Six pitches later, it was over.
Right.
And Mookie expressed it right after the game. He's like, he thought to himself, okay, take him out. This is great. Everybody else in that dugout thought the same thing because some pitchers have nights. Blake Snell was having a night.
Yeah,
he really was. And it was, I'm watching this going, I cannot believe this. I cannot believe this. But I can believe it because I've seen Tampa Bay quite a bit during my days in Boston. And it's what they do. And it works for them to a point. But when you get that far, sometimes you got to go off script. And he did.
Right. Sometimes go batter by batter. I mean, the guy was just... Yeah. He had the first three batters, you know, they struck him out twice already. Both of them.
Yeah. They're like, oh, I don't want to, we can't have him up there third time around. Well, why not? He's dominated him the first two times. I mean, if a guy gets a hit, you're not going to lose the game. But exactly. Go batter to batter and see what you can get out of him. I mean, he was really disappointed And frankly, you know, just my opinion, I think he was thrilled to go to San Diego and get out of there.
Yeah. The Dodgers went 43-17 in the regular season. Not too shabby. I know the Padres gave him a good. The Padres gave him a good fight, but it was really the Dodgers in full control. Was there any game that stood out above it all?
In the regular season, you know, the funny thing is the one game that really stood out was the one they lost to Houston in the two-game series in L.A., where Houston had lost, I don't know, a bunch in a row coming in. They were playing horrible baseball, and they came in and won the first game. They came back to do it, and I just said, this can't happen. And they went out and won the next night. But that one really stood out. You know, it's funny. When a team wins a lot, when you're around a team that wins all the time, it's the losses that stand out more than the wins. Even though you've got some great comeback wins, I think there was one in Arizona where Edwin Rios hit a walk-off, two-run leadoff home run against Diamondback because of the new extra innings rule. This guy's second base already. Right. He hammered one. And then Max Muncy had a walk-off sacrifice fly with nobody out.
Right.
You know, it's an unearned run to the pitcher, but whatever. That new rule, I think, is going away. I mean, I would like to see it modified where maybe you get to the 15th inning, they do it or something like that. But in the 10th, I don't like it.
Right. That must have been strange. That must have been strange at the broadcasting a leadoff two-run homer.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is I had to figure out how I was going to mark this in my scorebook because I had never done that, right? I had seen it before in the Olympics in softball, but not in baseball. So I don't even remember how I did it then. I don't think I had to score a game that way. But so I called my son, my oldest son, who worked in the Florida State League calling games for the Pirates affiliate there. They actually had that rule. And I said, what did you put in your scorebook? And he told me he just, you know, put the guy at second base. And he said, that's all I did. He goes, I really didn't know what to do. So what I did is I put the guy at second base, makes it look like a double. Instead of where the writing double, I put PR, placed runner. And so that's how I would know where he was. But that's all new for us. We're all figuring it out, some of the stuff as we go. But it was weird. You know, the extra inning stuff is – it helped last year. I get it. Seven-inning doubleheaders last year. I get it. We can go back to the nine-inning doubleheaders now.
Thank you. We're ready. Thank you.
And in the book, you definitely don't hide your displeasure with the Houston Astros and their sign stealing and that. And as a matter of fact, it was funny – You have one thing where the planes are flying up above, and one has the banner, and it says you can't steal this sign.
That's right. What was funny is we didn't know they were going to be doing that. So Rick Mundy and I are, because we did both of those games together, and we're starting to tape our pregame segment, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this plane where it shouldn't be, right above the stadium, and it's towing a banner, and so instead of stopping the recording, I kept going and doing it kind of live to the tape, like just as I look up, this is what I'm seeing. So we described it that way. And that was the first day. There was one plane. The second day, of course, we talked about it on the air quite a bit. And the second day, there were three planes. So other people got the idea. There were protesters outside the stadium. The organist and our stadium DJ were trolling them with every piece of ammunition they could come up with musically. And I think I put a list of the songs in the book that they were doing that, you know, like,
all in the book. That's
You're
what's
cheating
great.
Hard. And, you know, I Saw the Sign by Ace of Base was a good one, but look, I've been around. I know that for years, teams have been cheating for years. Okay. There's many, many teams that would focus cameras on the third base coach or the bench coach to try to get signs. It's been happening a long time. Now, Major League Baseball cracked down on that. That's part of baseball's dirty little secret is that that's been going on league-wide for years. They've cracked down on it. I was with the Red Sox when they had the Fitbit watch scandal. Everybody called it the smart watch or the Apple watch. No, I know the guy. I know what kind of watch he had. It was a Fitbit watch. I know what they did. And what they did was one of the players who was a Yankee the year before brought the trick over from the Yankees. And the Red Sox used it against the Yankees.
Uh-huh.
So the Yankees were upset and they turned in the Red Sox, who then went and turned in the Yankees for using the camera on their coaches. So it became a, you know, and Rob Manfred was just like, all right, enough. enough. We're cracking down, and now every camera has to be registered inside a ballpark. So there's a lot of little things behind the scenes that people don't know about, but that baseball doesn't want people to know about. But that's definitely one of the dirty little secrets. That the Astros weren't the only ones cheating, but they were probably the ones that were cheating the most egregiously and in real time. They were able to do it in real time where everybody else had to watch videos and then go back and decipher them. They, you know, they're still getting what they earned no matter where they go on the road. And it was brutal this year when they came to Dodger Stadium. Absolutely brutal on them.
The book is called COVID Curveball, the inside view of the 2020 Los Angeles Dodgers World Championship season. We're here with Tim Neverett. Tim, and we appreciate your time. We have a couple more questions for you. In the playoffs, the Dodgers, they had a hard time with the Braves. But then there was what you call a Mookie moment. They were down 3-1, and then Mookie robs Freddie Freeman home run. I mean, I guess you really like those Mookie moments.
Yeah, when I was in Boston and he was there, it came out one time during a game, totally just like blurted it out. It's a Mookie moment. And I do it every so often in LA, but not a lot, but I'll probably hopefully do it a little bit more here in the coming days. But I think that, he is a game changer defensively, offensively, with his feet. He did things with his feet in the postseason that I've never seen anybody do. And he's one of the most remarkable players I've ever seen. You know, I was actually talking to him the other day on the field about, I write in the book about, you know, the night that my dad passed and the day after when he took a picture with me. And I said, do you remember when we took that picture at Fenway? He goes, yeah, I do. I remember that day. He goes, I know that was a bad day for you. I said, yeah. I said, but do you know the rest of the story? He said, no. So I got to tell him that when I got the picture framed and gave it to my mother, she went to the couch, took pictures of my own kids down and put that picture of Mookie up there. And he laughed. He thought that was great. But that's what happened. But Mookie is he's a special person. I root for Mookie pretty hard. I don't have a lot of favorites, but I'll say that he is one of them because I've seen him play so much and I've seen him do some remarkable things on the baseball field that I've never seen anybody do. And he's a game changer, and the Dodgers knew it. That's why they locked him up long term. He's very happy in LA. I know he's going to have some great moments here down the stretch, and he could have some more Mookie moments in the postseason this year as he hopes to carry them to another World Series win.
Well, they got to catch the Giants, and it's going to be a hard fought down to the wire, but the Dodgers are definitely in great position. You can get the book at, I guess, Amazon, but you go to your local bookstore. If they don't have it, ask for it. They can always order it. Tim, this has been great. We appreciate you having you on. Anything else you'd like to say before we let you go?
Yeah, thank you very much. It's available in hardcover, Kindle, and also an audiobook is available. It's on audible.com, but do some one-stop shopping at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you're going to get your books. And also, because we can't do a lot of book events at bookstores due to COVID still, what we've been doing is going on social media, either Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and offering an opportunity for people to get signed copies that way. All they have to do is message me on any one of those social media platforms, and I'll get back to them with details on how they can get a signed book shipped to them.
And I also saw on social media that one of your good friends, who was a guest on our podcast, also Eric Sherman, I saw him with the book on social media.
Yeah, he was out here with me in LA last week. He's working on another book project that you guys will probably have to talk to him about sometime in the future. But so I was helping him with some people out here in LA, and he was here for about a week and went back, but he's doing well. And he and I are former college teammates. So we've known each other a long, long time, and we've always stayed in touch, and we see each other quite a bit over the course of the year.
Yeah. Eric's a good guy.
Yeah.
And when Jeff and I are reading a book, we'll call each other. Like we saw Eric Sherman, and then you mentioned an article in the Wall Street Journal that Jared Diamond had written, and he was a guest of ours for his book Swing Kings. We called Jeff. Did you see? He mentioned Jared Diamond.
just a lot of
other guests.
Just happens to be, these different people that we've had on in the book.
That's good.
It's terrific. Yeah. It's, 6 degrees or whatever you call it. So it's nice to see all the connections.
And yes.
We greatly appreciate you coming on the show, Tim.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. I'm glad you're enjoying the book. I'm glad you've enjoyed it. Glad you're telling people about it, because it's kind of an important document, too, I think, chronicling a world championship season. And I think that there's a lot of other messages in there too, that I think people would be interested in knowing. I mean, a lot of those stories I've never told before. I didn't want the book to be about me. I wanted to kind of weave what I was experiencing and have experienced into this realm. And I didn't try to take you inside the clubhouse because I wasn't allowed there. So why fake it? Right. So I took you where I was allowed to go. I talked to the people I was allowed to in the only ways I could, which was through Zoom. I didn't do one one-on-one interview face-to-face the entire season. I did some on television where I could see the guys on camera. They could see me on the monitor, but that was it. And I actually went down to Dave Roberts the other day and I said, Dave, do you realize this is the first face-to-face conversation we've had in over a year? He goes, I do realize that. And he goes, I think it stinks. So it's coming back slowly in terms of how we cover the game, because without being there, in fact, I was just watching the Yankee telecast, and they were saying how much they don't like not seeing the game in front of them. And I sympathize with them. I really do, because I get it. Hopefully we'll be back on the road next season. I know we're not going anywhere this year, but hopefully we can go back and tell the real story the way it is, instead of watching it on television. Because it's like, if you're a news editor, you tell your reporter, well, why don't you stay home, watch the other channel's coverage of that fire, and then report on it.
All right.
That's exactly what it is. The book even has a foreword by Oral Hershiser, which is a fun read too.
Yeah.
So
yeah, Oral did a great job with it. Did a fantastic job with it. He takes you right into his brain just before he throws the last pitch of the 88 World Series and then bridges it to 2020. He did a really good job. I know the editors at the publishing house they got back to me after they read it and they were like, wow, that is pretty detailed. That's really good. We didn't expect that, but we're glad he did it.
Tim, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it. And good luck for you and the Dodgers the rest of the season.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to do it and look forward to talking to you guys again someday.
Thank you. We would like that. Thanks, Tim.
Okay. And thank you to Tim.
Wow.
Yeah. The 2020 baseball season. I think he covered it pretty well, you know?
Yeah. You know, you don't realize till you read this book. I mean, you know that all this stuff went on, but that's a year that you're just not going to forget.
No. But you know what? The Dodgers have a pretty good team to follow it up. They just might go back to back.
They might. That was a season that they, you know, every game, what was so exciting about that season, if you got to look at the positives, you got to look at the excitement, is it was almost like a football season where every game means something. You know, 16 games, they all mean something, pretty much. And with 60 games, it's not like with 162 where, you know, you win a few, you lose a few. 60 games, you really have to, you lose 5 or 6 games in a row and it's, you know, your season could be over.
Yeah, I mean, our Mets could have used a 60-game season this year in the playoffs.
Oh, please. Oh. You know what, Jeff, I got to tell you, if I had been at Yankee Stadium for just a couple more hours that day, they may have converted me. I think that was a conversion day. Oh, I think that's what the purpose of the day was, to convert us into Yankee fans. But anyway, Jeff, we've got to thank Joey Machado, Tim Neverett. We've got to thank Bree Blackford of Elda's Kitchen. Don't forget the contest, people.
Who's Elda?
That's right. Who is Elda?
Remember, email us, baseballandbbq@gmail.com with your answer.
Jeff, that's episode 102.
Yes, in the books.
And 103 is just going to be as good, maybe better.
Maybe.
But the one thing I do know about it is I will see you there.
Take us out with Ace and Bobo.
From our friends, the poet, Shel Krakowski, the musician, Dave Dresser. See ya.
Yeah. taste sweet.